Today is Thursday, March 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up...
Obviously Brexit is, a huge, I think, impediment to British influence on the world stage. It's not only the uncertainty of this process, but Brexit itself means that Britain will lose, I think, one of its main leverage for influence, which was being part of the UK.
Well, coming up, that's on our Brexit story. We'll have that coming up. Also ahead, French aviation investigators began analyzing the flight data recorders from the American-made jetliner that crashed in Ethiopia on Sunday, killing 157 people. And 3 days of voting in Britain's parliament culminates today, with lawmakers deciding whether to ask the EU for a delay in Britain's exit from the bloc. It's all on today's International Edition. In our top world story today, this week, Britain's parliament has held several votes over the country's plan to leave the EU, Brexit. Tonight, parliament is voting on delaying Brexit. Originally, Britain was scheduled to end its membership in the economic and political bloc on March 29th. Benjamin Haddad is the director of the Future Europe Initiative at the Atlantic Council here in Washington. He spoke with my colleague, Kate Pound-Dawson, about the effect the long Brexit process has on the UK.
Obviously Brexit is, a huge, I think, impediment to British influence on the world stage. It's not only the uncertainty of this process, but Brexit itself means that Britain will lose, I think, one of its main leverage for influence, which was being part of the European Union, being part of this decision-making process in one of the largest trading bloc in the world, could, participate to elaborating sanctions against Russia, could participate to the huge development and humanitarian aid machine that the European Union is. And instead, we see now a country that is one of the two main military actors in Europe, or one of the main economies in Europe, being incredibly inward-looking and being focused on this process that's taking a long time. And I think this isn't good news for anyone, either for Britain or for its European partners or for the United States.
What does it mean for, as you mentioned, some of its other partners, the United States, the Commonwealth countries, traditional allies and friends such as Canada, Australia? How does this affect those relationships?
Well, the initial objective of a lot of the people who supported Brexit during the campaign was what they called global Britain. They said, well, Britain will be free to be able to negotiate some free trade agreements, will be able to rely on partners in the Commonwealth, will be able to conduct its own completely independent foreign policy. But what we're seeing is exactly the opposite, which is that right now Britain is very inward looking and really focused on domestic issues. Beyond the law, beyond the institutions, politically, it means a country that doesn't have a very strong voice on the international stage today, can't really make a difference to defend its own vision. And so I think that's bad news for everyone.
Now, if there is a vote for a second referendum, if the parliament agrees to hold a second referendum, is that going to increase the uncertainty, or would it lend more clarity for Parliament as it moves forward?
No, I think clearly it will need more uncertainty. I mean, the first question about a second referendum is, what are we talking about? What's the question being asked? Are we redoing the referendum from 2 years ago? I think that's unlikely. 3 years ago, in 2016, on the question of leaving the European Union. Is it a referendum on the current deal that Parliament isn't able to agree on? I think clearly the partners of the United Kingdom will want clarity. If the United Kingdom demands an extension, a delay for Brexit, first of all, have to see how long is this delay. Is it 2 months, 21 months? There's a lot of different options that are circulating right now. But I think the first thing that the Europeans will ask from Britain is a clarification of why it's demanding an extension. I think this no deal would be bad for everyone. I think it's important to be able to establish the future relationship and transition before that future relationship as the UK leaves the European Union, it will be better if it's done in an orderly fashion. If we can't agree on the deal, then at least let's have some clarity over what's next. And clearly right now, this uncertainty is hurtful.
That was Benjamin Haddad with the Atlantic Council. He was discussing Britain's effort to leave the EU with VOA's Kate Pound Dawson. Well, former U.S. Congressman Beto O'Rourke announced today he is joining the race for the Democratic Party's nomination in the 2020 presidential election. O'Rourke joins a crowded field of Democrats who want to challenge Republican President Donald Trump. Those who have already announced include Senators Cory Booker, Kirsten Gillibrand, Kamala Harris, Amy Klobuchar, Bernie Sanders, and Elizabeth Warren, as well as Representative Tulsi Gabbard and former Housing and Urban Development Secretary Julian Castro. Former Vice President Joe Biden also continues to edge closer to a run for president and dropping strong hints an official announcement could come in a matter of weeks. Well, joining me here in the studio is VOA national correspondent Jim Malone for a closer look at the Democratic race for the presidency. And Jim, thank you so much for joining me. So today we have another Democratic presidential candidate, and he's thrown his hat into the ring. So can you tell us a little bit about him?
Yeah, Beto O'Rourke kind of made a national sensation last year during the midterm elections. He ran a very strong Senate race in Texas, narrowly losing to the incumbent Ted Cruz, a Republican stalwart who had run for president himself in 2016. O'Rourke made quite an impression with younger people. He drew diverse crowds. He's from a Hispanic area of Texas near the border with Mexico, the El Paso area. And he also showed a real ability to raise a lot of money, which is important in politics, especially from smaller donors, not so much corporate interests. So O'Rourke made quite a splash. He gained a sort of national following, especially among younger people around the country. And now he's decided to throw his hat in the ring, as they say.
Very interesting. Well, in addition, former Vice President Joe Biden is also considering running. So how good of a chance does he have with so many others in the race?
Well, Biden is at the top of the polls, but not by much. If you look at the sort of national polls and the polls in some of the early key voting states like Iowa and New Hampshire, you're going to see people like Joe Biden up around 30%. Bernie Sanders is right in there because he ran 4 years ago in 2016 and had a popular following. And after that, the field is kind of, broad and diffuse. There are no real favorites. And that's where O'Rourke would find himself in. One candidate who might have had a little traction, I think, since she has announced is Kamala Harris of California. She's developing a following. And what you have is this more than a dozen now Democratic candidates. They're quite varied, diverse, several women contenders, a number of minorities. So it's a very wide field in terms of their backgrounds, but also in terms of their policy leanings. And someone like Biden could come in. He might be seen as more moderate. The question is that a good or a bad thing? Because a lot of the Democrats are leaning a bit to the left this year. But there is one kind of unifying principle that we're hearing so far is they want to find someone who can defeat President Trump.
Yes. Also, was it surprising to hear that Hillary Clinton is not running?
Not really. I think there was not a great groundswell for her to make another run. And particularly where you have several women contenders now, a lot of senators in the race, some of them you ticked off earlier. Certainly, if women voters are very insistent on a particular agenda that would be furthered by a woman candidate, they have several choices to choose from now.
Is this unusual to have so many Democrats at this point before the election?
Well, you know, the election cycles are getting longer. That is, people are getting in earlier and earlier. You know, about 2 years out now is really when you have to start to prepare. And if you look back to the 2016 race where you had two Democrats facing off, it was Clinton and Sanders, but you had about 16, 17 Republicans. And so the Democrats now are sort of repeating that. It's a wide open field. I mean, even though you have someone like Biden who's well known and considered a top contender, no one has a stranglehold on the nomination. And I think that's another reason why O'Rourke could have decided to get in, because no one is running away with the field. It's wide open, and it's going to be to a great extent on how voters perceive their different personalities. And he has a strong kind of earnest quality about him, authentic quality, that could help him separate himself from the rest of the field.
Okay, very good. Very interesting. Thank you. That's VOA national correspondent Jim Malone. Well, French aviation investigators began analyzing the flight data recorders today from the American-made jetliner that crashed in Ethiopia on Sunday, killing 157 people from about 30 different countries. The crash of the Ethiopian Airlines Boeing 737 MAX 8 was the model's second deadly accident since October, when 189 people were killed after a Lion Air jetliner crashed in Indonesia. Yesterday, the United States said new information about the Ethiopian Airlines crash led it to order the MAX 8 jets grounded in the U.S., following dozens of other countries and airlines that had halted flights of the jets. Since the first crash, investigators have focused on the aircraft's anti-stall system that dips the plane's nose down to prevent it from stalling. Well, following the lead of more than 30 other countries, the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration has ordered the immediate grounding of the entire MAX series of Boeing jetliners. Details from VOA's White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman.
The action to halt all flights of the Boeing MAX planes in American airspace is a quick and sudden reversal of the stance taken by the manufacturer, the U.S. airlines flying them, and the administration of President Donald Trump, who had contended there was no reason to order a grounding despite fatal nosedive crashes of two of the planes in Indonesia and Ethiopia. Trump says he ultimately decided issuing an emergency order was the right thing to do.
The United States has the greatest record in the world of aviation, and we want to keep it that way. So I didn't want to take any chances.
Until Sunday's crash in Ethiopia, there were nearly 400 of the planes in operation worldwide. Now, all are believed to have been ordered grounded or forbidden from flying in most international airspace. Steve Herman, VOA News, at the White House.
Among the top stories in the world, India expresses disappointment that a measure by the UN Security Council to name the head of the Islamic militant group, Jaish-e-Mohammed, JEM, as a global terrorist, has been blocked by China. The dismissal of a provincial police chief in northern Afghanistan triggers armed clashes today between his loyalist and national security forces. And China's top legislature is expected to pass the country's first foreign investment law this week, at a time when negotiators from Beijing and Washington work to hammer out a trade deal. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA's recently retired planet-hunting Kepler Space Telescope has discovered thousands of planets since its launch in 2009. The first exoplanet candidate to be discovered by the space telescope is called Kepler-1658b. At first, the massive hot Jupiter planet was categorized as an exoplanet candidate, then was listed as a false positive when scientists didn't think the data indicated an actual planet. The scientists changed their minds later when it was again reclassified as an exoplanet candidate. An international team of astronomers led by University of Hawaii graduate student Ashley Chontos reported that Kepler-1658b has finally been confirmed as an actual planet. The team's research was recently presented at the Kepler K2 Science Conference in Glendale, California. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. A report critical of Iran's worsening human rights situation and the harsh crackdown against people protesting declining living standards is under review this week at the UN Human Rights Council. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The UN Special Investigator on the Human Rights Situation in Iran, Javed Rehman, says Iran faces myriad challenges, many related to rising inflation and generally deteriorating economic and social conditions. He says demonstrations are growing around strikes, protesting working conditions, late or unpaid wages, food shortages, and lack of health care. He says the hardships likely will worsen as secondary sanctions reimposed by the United States take effect. He says concerns about human rights and the rights to freedom of peaceful assembly and to association are mounting as popular discontent increases.
Worrying patterns of intimidation, arrest, prosecution, and ill-treatment of human rights defenders, lawyers, and labor rights activists signal an increasingly severe state response.
Raymond says lawyers, political opponents, journalists, and other individuals who are arrested are accused by the government of offenses punishable by death or life in prison. He says few receive a fair trial and many are subjected to ill treatment to get them to confess. He says he's particularly concerned about an Iranian law that permits the execution of children.
Iranian law today allows girls as young as 9 years and boys as young as 15 years to be sentenced to death for certain crimes. As a result, individuals aged below the age of 18 years, when they allegedly commit certain crimes, have been executed.
The UN expert says at least 21 children have been sentenced to death and at least 33 have been executed since 2013. He says at least 85 child offenders reportedly are languishing on death row and 6 were executed last year. Iran's ambassador to the UN in Geneva, Ismail Baghey Hamani, contests that. He says the execution of children aged 9 and 15 is not true because it has never happened. He says capital punishment is only for the most serious crimes and is imposed after due process in accordance with the law. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thank you, Lisa. Well, police in Brazil are sorting out why two heavily armed former students burst into their school outside Sao Paulo yesterday, opened fire and killed 8 students and officials and wounded more than a dozen others. Police say the masked 17 and 25-year-old assailants tried to get inside a room where students were hiding and shot and killed themselves as officers moved in. A candlelight vigil was held near the school last night in memory of the 5 students and 3 school officials killed. Investigators seized weapons and writings from the shooters, including the 17-year-old shooter whose mother said her son was bullied at the school. A teacher told police officers the same thing, and officers believe the pair may have been planning the attack for about a year. This is VOA's International Edition.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Press Conference USA. This week, a newsmaker interview with first-term Congresswoman Abigail Spanberger, a Democrat from the state of Virginia. We'll talk with her about a range of domestic and foreign policy issues, from immigration reform to the U.S. role in the world. That's Press Conference USA this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
The 2019 VOA calendars are in. This year's calendar features a variety of scenic photos that capture U.S. byways, including beautiful photos of the Big Sur Coast Highway and even the historic Route 66. Tune in to Border Crossings at 1500 Universal to request a free calendar.
United Nations investigators say intercommunal attacks that killed more than 500 people in the DRC were orchestrated. The investigators from the UN Human Rights Office in Congo say the attacks may amount to crimes against humanity. We have Lisa Schlein again reporting for VOA from Geneva.
The clashes between the Banunu and Batende communities took place in Yumbi territory in Mai Ndombe province between December 16th and 18th. UN investigators who went there found the violence was planned and carried out with the support of traditional chiefs. UN human rights spokeswoman Ravina Shandasani says the investigators verified at least 535 people were killed and more than 100 others injured.
These figures are most likely an underestimate. The number of casualties is believed to be much higher, as the bodies of some who died are believed to have been thrown into the Congo River. It's also not possible to confirm the number of people who are still missing, as an estimated 19,000 people were displaced by the violence, 16,000 of whom crossed over into the Republic of Congo.
Shamdasani says fights between the two communities over land and fishing resources have broken out in the past, but never on this scale. She says the violence was triggered by a dispute over the burial of a Banunu chief. She says the similarity of the attacks carried out over a three-day period across four different villages indicates prior consultation and organization.
Certain chiefs of the Batende majority villages were cited by many sources as having taken part in the planning of the attacks. The investigation concluded that the crimes documented in Yumbi may amount to crimes against humanity of murder, torture, rape, and other forms of sexual violence, as well as persecution.
The report warns violence is likely to flare up again if the tensions and resentment between the two communities are allowed to fester. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, is calling for the perpetrators of the crimes to be punished. She is also urging the government to establish a truth and reconciliation process to address the problems between the Banunu and Batende communities and prevent further violence. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A new public exhibition has opened in Australia, charting the country's history of espionage and revealing the personal experiences of secret agents. It features the gadgets they used, surveillance images, and case studies. Phil Mercer reports from Sydney.
This is the first time an Australian intelligence agency has taken part in a public exhibition. Officials hope it will help Australians to consider the nature and purpose of the nation's security organisations at a time when new threats both at home and overseas are emerging. The exhibition explores the age-old challenge of balancing the needs of national security and human rights. The display at Western Sydney University asks whether students who took part in a May Day march in Australia in 1966 or women involved in the anti-conscription Save Our Sons movement were really a threat to the country. Leanne Smith is the director of the Whitlam Institute at Western Sydney University.
Whether it's 1901, 1950, 1970 or now, you can see in each case this tension between national security and individual and community rights and liberties, but also the potential for influence of politics onto national security. It certainly raises a lot of the questions that you could have in a contemporary conversation around national security and human rights today.
Among several case studies on display is one of the most dramatic episodes in Australia's Cold War history. In 1954, Vladimir Petrov, a diplomat at the Soviet embassy in Canberra, defected. He'd passed a file on Soviet activities in Australia in return for cash and political asylum. Petrov and his wife Evdokia had been working as spies, but feared they'd be killed if they went back to the Soviet Union a year after the death of the dictator Joseph Stalin. Also on display at the exhibition in Sydney are gadgets used by Australian spies, including recording equipment hidden in radios, cameras hidden in books, and letters written in invisible ink. Curators say the display gives visitors an opportunity to look at the real stories of espionage behind the gloss of make-believe. Australia has six main intelligence agencies, including the Australian Security Intelligence Organisation. Its work is often compared to the FBI in the United States or Britain's MI5. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Thank you, Phil. You've been listening to International Edition. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, and our engineer, Rob McLean. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.